You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So, as I said, I have been looking into gender politics and how society responds to women as political leaders. This is particularly in response to the recent change in political leadership for the National Party, which means that New Zealand now has two women in the top parliamentary leadership spots, Jacinda Ardern as Prime Minister and Judith Collins as opposition leader, which is interesting going into the election later this year. Firstly, I was interested in looking into whether it is an unusual occurrence to have women in two top political leadership roles in comparison to other countries across the world. I reached out to a number of people, and Victoria University of Wellington History Professor Dolores Januszewski provided some interesting information about women in leadership positions in New Zealand and globally. She reminded me of the 1997 election where Prime Minister and National Party leader at the time, Jenny Shipley, was paired against Labour Party leader and opposition leader Helen Clark in a reverse to the pairing of Collins and Ardern this election year. Then in 2008, when there was significant backlash from Labour opponents and critics who called Helen Clark's government Helengrad to describe the iron grip of Clark over Wellington as Prime Minister in reference to the socialist and communist movements in the Soviet Union. Dolores noted that the United States has never had a woman in the presidential position and said that she knows that female leadership does provoke tensions amongst men, which is part of the reason she thinks Hillary Clinton lost to Trump in 2016 and Helen Clark lost in 2008 when the National Party had chosen John Key as their leadership candidate. Dolores also said that, like New Zealand now, Finland has a female prime minister, the youngest in the world, and also has a female in the leader of the opposition position. After thinking about the response to women leaders in regard to labels like Helengrad, I wanted to talk more about how the public responds to women in politics and how gender stereotypes play into the way the media presents women in politics and whether this is different to the way men are represented. I spoke to Dr. Claire Timperley, a politics lecturer from the Victoria University of Wellington, about women leaders in New Zealand and how gender politics are often something that is only spoken about when people discuss women politicians. Here is clear. How often are two women in the top state leadership roles? Is this sort of an unusual occurrence, or is this something that happens quite often in politics around the world?
So around the world, it's not very common, but I think that in the New Zealand context, we've actually seen it more regularly than we've seen across the world. So, and in fact, in New Zealand, we've seen women occupying kind of high-level state positions quite frequently. So if we think about the Governor General and the Chief Justice, Leader of the Opposition, the Prime Minister, we've actually seen, in modern New Zealand history, I should say, women occupying those high positions. So I think the fact that at the moment we currently have a Prime Minister who's a woman and the Leader of the Opposition who's a woman is unusual in a global sense, but in a New Zealand context, I don't think it's hugely unusual, although obviously it is generating quite a lot of interest. And in fact, you only have to go back to the 1990s to see Helen Clark and Jenny Shipley were both occupying those positions when they were campaigning against each other.
Do you think that the public responds differently to women in political leadership positions than perhaps they respond to men?
So I think there is quite a lot of evidence that they do. A lot of the kind of more quantitative research evidence comes from the US, so it's a little. I'm a little cautious about drawing
similarities, I suppose, because it is quite different.
it's different context, but I think it is clear that there's gendered language that we see used both by politicians, by the public, and also by the media to talk about candidates. Even just the fact that there's attention given to the gender of candidates when it is women, but we don't see the same gender when there are two men candidates running. We don't have a conversation about what it means to have two men running for office. We focus on other things in those races. So the fact that we're talking about the gender of these two politicians, I think, in and of itself indicates there's some kind of gendered analysis going on. And we do know that there is, just the the fact that we're talking about their gender means we aren't spending time talking about policies or other things that we might be talking about if it weren't for their gender.
Yeah, so just to further in on that sort of gender idea and being placed in a role as a woman politician, there have been a number of women in leadership positions across the world that have been labelled, I suppose is the word. UK Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was dubbed the Iron Lady. New opposition leader Judith Collins is commonly referred to as Crusher. And also Helen Clark and Jacinda Ardern have been consistently linked with the idea of the nanny state. And Ardern was said to be unfit for leadership as a pregnant, newly elected prime minister. Are these labels, I suppose, linked to these gender stereotypes or masculine and feminine roles expected by society?
Yeah, I think it's hard not to draw that conclusion. One of the ways that I think about it is, can I think of how men have been, men in similar positions being portrayed? Are there similar labels that have been assigned to them? But even then, if we can, I'm trying to think right now, actually, of an example of a man who has had, I don't know, a label that is related to his gender.
Yeah,
The only things
I can sort of think of, I suppose, is that, I don't know, everybody used to say, John Key, you can have him round for a barbecue. That was sort of the thing. Or I know there was Kiwi Keith, there was Keith Holyoke, and that was his thing. But it's not necessarily as gendered, I think, as perhaps, I don't know, being called Crusher, like a man that was staunch in their position, in their conservative position, I suppose, wouldn't necessarily be labelled a word like that. I don't know.
Well, and I think part of what you're getting at also is the connotations for masculine versus feminine traits. So masculine traits tend to be positively connoted, especially in leadership positions, whereas feminine traits tend to be negatively connoted. And we actually have seen some of that already coming out. Judith Collins was talking about Jacinda Ardern being labelled kind. Kind is often a characteristic that is associated with women, but Judith Collins was saying, well, I don't think that that's actually a very, sort of saying, that's not a compliment. I think that it's kinder to have good policies and to, rather than talk, I think she was saying, rather than talking about kindness all the time, which suggests maybe you're not very kind because you need to talk about it all the time, maybe you just need to enact policies and be doing things which would be kind through action rather than through words. But it's sort of interesting there as well, just to think about the ways in which I think Jacinda Ardern is quite an interesting leader, that she's embraced what is traditionally considered a feminine concept and therefore has relation or kind of notions in the public consciousness potentially of weakness or kind of, yeah, might be negatively connoted, and she's really embraced that concept.
Yeah,
and she's embraced that concept and tried to redefine it as something positive. And so I think that's been a really interesting part of her leadership and the kind of politics that has emerged over the past few years. But I think, yeah, kind of returning to that question about kind of what it means to be depicted negatively in the media, I think that the negativity sometimes comes out just in the fact that when we think, I mean, this kind of goes back to Sheryl Sandberg's work about leadership, that when you have masculine characteristics, they're often positively connoted, especially if you're a man. And if you display feminine characteristics, in general, they're negatively connoted in relation to leadership. But especially if you're a woman, you're facing a double bind, because you want, if you act in a masculine way, and we can think of female or women politicians who have acted in masculine ways, they still can't win, because then they get kind of berated for not being feminine enough or being somehow deviant. So I think women politicians do find themselves in a challenging space when they occupy positions of leadership that traditionally have been thought of in kind of masculine ways.
That was Dr. Claire Timperley talking about gender politics. I just wanted to say, in particular reference to people texting in about different names of politicians, perhaps it is a politics thing. I know in Parliament they all yell at each other and say horrendous things all the time. Somebody texted in saying, Piggy Muldoon, imagine calling a woman that, you wouldn't, would you? But then I was thinking, sort of brought me to think about when Jacinda Ardern was called lipstick on a pig by Gareth Morgan from the Opportunities Party around the election last year, which is interesting as well. So perhaps it is just a politics thing. But again, further on this conversation I had with Dr. Claire Timperley, someone has also texted in saying perhaps one of the reasons that their gender is highlighted is that women do genuinely bring a different approach and a refreshing perspective to leadership. We are going to talk a little bit more about that with Claire, because I spoke about the impact women have in Parliament and Cabinet and what effect they have on representation. We discuss the diversity of the National and Labour Party lists, and Claire goes into political theory about the importance of representation in government. I began by asking whether there are a particular set of circumstances that perhaps led to having both Jacinda Ardern and Judith Collins in these roles in the lead up to the election.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can think of any kind of causal relationship between why they're there, I guess. At this moment, obviously, the National Party didn't necessarily plan for Judith Collins to be in the leadership role right now. I do think it's a really interesting, or it will be an interesting campaign and election given the backdrop of COVID-19 and the fact that we've seen there are really clear inequalities in New Zealand society which have been exposed as a result of COVID-19. They were always there, but during the lockdown we saw some of the real negative effects, especially on those who don't own their own housing, who are in often essential workers, people who are in jobs where they had to go out, food insecurity, so kind of people who didn't have as many resources really suffered under the lockdown. And so in many ways I think that kind of raised in the public consciousness some of the inequality which is rife in New Zealand society. And I think the leadership and the government that forms after the 2020 election is going to be really important in terms of how and whether those inequalities are addressed.
But do you think having the presence of women in Parliament and in Cabinet impact the way policy is made?
Yeah, so we actually have quite a lot of research on this. So there's certainly a distinction between the presence of women in the legislature, so in Parliament in general, and the presence of women in the executive. So it's important to have women present in the legislature, but it is they might have less of an effect than women who are in the executive for obvious reasons, because it's the executive that has, especially in a New Zealand context, a lot of the power to develop policy and to to govern, essentially. And I think this is why there's been so much attention given to National Party's list, and especially the top 20 candidates. So I had a little look earlier, and if I've counted correctly, in the top 10 positions, 2 out of the 10 are women, so that's 1/5 of the top 10 are women, and in the top 20, 6 of those candidates are women, so it's about 30%. And so if we assume, if National were to get into government, that in Cabinet there are the top 20 usually kind of become the Cabinet, 30% of the Cabinet would be women, and we know from the research that you need a critical mass of women in order to start to substantively affect the policy that emerges from that government. And there's lots of different answers as to what that critical mass is. But if we look at theories of the politics of presence, which says that having good representation matters, and that good representation entails the people in governing positions looking roughly like the population, then I think there is cause for concern that the National Party list doesn't look as representative of New Zealand as we would expect it to be if we were to have good representation.
So how does representation affect policy making? Does it affect it in the way that its quality and the way that it obviously reflects greater society, or does it potentially affect sort of the focus areas of where, you know, a government wants to take their policy, and what action they actually want to take while they have the opportunity to govern?
There's quite a complex response to that. So there's a few different things. So, well, if I come back to kind of Judith Collins' own statements about this, she has said that the party has diversity of thought and that it's more important to, quote, be representative than to look representative. And so I would take issue with that in a couple of ways. So first of all, we know that symbolic representation in and of itself is important. So if we leave aside policy making itself, we know that publics view governments as more legitimate when they do look more like the population. So that, in terms of democratic legitimacy and people having buy into the political system, in and of itself is an important goal, I guess, of representation. But then in terms of thinking about the substance of the policy, so there is this distinction in the literature between the politics of ideas and the politics of presence. And the politics of ideas is the camp of people, I guess, who think that what matters in representation is a contest of ideas, and that as long as you have people kind of across the political spectrum from left to right represented, you've got a good contest of ideas, and that's going to result in good policy making. What those who advocate for a politics of presence argue is that representation is not simply a contest of ideas, but also the representation of identities and experiences, and that we're only going to get good representation if we have, for example, roughly 50% men and 50% women, because otherwise you get distortions like sort of the Margaret Thatcher concern, that you've got a woman in politics, but maybe she doesn't necessarily espouse feminist values. So you kind of need to have enough people representing groups that you get some of the diversity of thought within those groups. But part of the justification for the politics of presence is not just that identities and experiences matter, but that our opinions are actually quite unstable. So even though we think of political ideologies as being kind of maybe somewhat clear set of principles, those principles actually don't govern policy making all the way down. And so that one of the reasons we care about having people with different identities and experiences governing us is that as things change in the policy space, so for example, when COVID came along kind of out of left field, we want to have people in government who come from a range of different backgrounds and experiences, because they will be able to bring those experiences and perspectives to bear on that policy issue. Whereas if you have people who all come from a relatively narrow section of society, so they're middle class, they're white, or they're predominantly men, they might have a particular set of experiences, which means that it obscures certain problems. They're not able to see all of the kind of the complexities around addressing any particular issue, especially those issues that aren't long-standing issues. They sort of come out of nowhere. So you can think of the terror attacks, you can think of the volcano eruption, you can think of COVID-19. These are all things where you want a diverse set of representatives who are able to think about, kind of bring a whole variety of perspectives to bear on these difficult issues.
I'm just trying to think whether I've got anything else to sort of add to the end of that.
There was one more thing that I kind of did want to draw out, and I don't know if this is a bit, But I just also think that it is worth noting that Judith Collins and Jacinda Ardern, if we are going to kind of think about it, is a contest between these two women. They are both white middle-class women. And in feminist theory, we often talk about the but-for candidates. So but-for their gender, they are essentially the same as the dominant group in politics, or the group that traditionally has dominance in politics.
That's very true.
So I think it is also worth thinking about in the context of this leadership contest, but also in the politics in general. Whilst it is important to think about the role of gender in politics, it's also important to think more broadly about kind of intersectional concerns. So the fact that they are still white middle-class women, or even upper-class women now, means the representation is still fairly single-faceted in that regard. And I think it's probably worth thinking about that when you look at the National Party list and when you look at the Labour Party list, just thinking about all those intersectional identities, not just gender.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.